I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Tim Hernandez.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Our guest today is El Paso-based filmmaker and poet Valentin Sandoval.
And his new book is called The South Sun Rises, a bilingual poetic narrative of the borderland. And it is the story, you know, a story emerges from the poetry about your family, your experience, and what it's like living on the border of El Paso and Ciudad Juarez. And he's in the studio with
us
today.
He's in the studio right now with us. Yes.
And it's always nice to have face-to-face conversations. And this guy is really interesting. Check out his webpage. I think it's valentinsandoval.com. So check that out, too. Get to know about this guy because he is an El Paso treasure.
That's right. He is. And, you know, it's not very often that we get to see the author's faces. So, and you have quite a face.
Yes.
So that's, you know, it's good to see your face here. Now, thanks for being here, Valentin.
Thank you for having me. I heard you guys when I came back from Albuquerque one time. I thought, who's Hernandez? Who's Chacon? But the show sounded great, you know, and cool. So I'm happy to be here.
Wait a minute. You didn't hear about us until the show?
No,
you know about us as writers? Get out!
Mind you, I was involved in production and TV and film. I knew nobody. I had to get back into it. But once I found out, I'm honored.
Okay. I'll quit being offended. But I do want, since we're talking about that intersection between, you're a filmmaker, you do a lot of important work, including political campaigns.
Right.
You're a poet. You're an activist. But one of those things that seems to tie those two worlds together is perhaps your relationship with Jimmy Santiago Baca. He is a poet. He's an activist. And now he even has a film company, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And tell us about your relationship with him and how. What are you guys doing?
Well, you know what? I haven't talked to him in a few months, you know, throughout the years. We always have sort of a love-hate thing going on.
Everybody has that with Jimmy.
Yes. That's what I've heard, yes.
And then the last time he says, stop using my name to make yourself famous. I'm like, nah, man.
Oh, is that what he said?
Yeah, no, I'm kidding. But,
he probably said it, but joking around.
I met him here about 15, 16 years ago. He came down to the Bridge Center for Contemporary Arts, a place David Romo used to have in downtown, like, 18 years ago.
Right. Yeah, I used to be on the board of that.
Were you?
Yeah, not 18 years ago, but
how long was that? Like 15, 16 years ago, something like that?
Well, I came here in 2000 and I joined the board in about 2001, and after I got there, pretty much it fell apart. No connection.
That's what happens when they invite you on.
Yeah, I know, right? But the reason why I ask is not just, you know, to drop his name and to but as I'm reading your book, and it's a fantastic narrative of your family, your parents, you living on the border, but I can't help but think of Martin and Meditations in the South Valley as I'm reading this,
right.
Especially not only how the narrative unfolds, but also the language seems that like it's almost told in a voice that is either influenced by or parallel to a soulmate to the voice of Martina Meditations in the South Valley.
You know, and it's probably a subconscious thing. When I saw Jimmy at the Bridge, and you know, he was a total ham, right? He goes, everybody's around him.
No,
and
not Jimmy.
And I go up to him afterwards, and I say behind his ear, I'm like, hey, that one page in 81 from Martina Meditations, you took that from Bukowski and Kerouac, man. Like, directly, you know.
Right.
And he looks back at me, he's like, who the hell are you, man? But he invites me over for a beer at the tap afterwards, and I say, yeah, let's go talk. And then at that point, that's when I had pitched to him. I said, whatever you're doing with your writing workshops in the prisons, in Chino Prison in California, I said, why don't you let me take my cameras and film? Because I think it's, you know, and he hadn't thought about that until I inserted the seed in his mind. And at the time I was working at La Fe Clinic, I was doing nonprofit. Mm-hmm. I was doing health education videos. I was taking, like, diabetes-based issues on Segundo Barrio and having to draw 24-minute plays and video adaptations for education. So I had access to the equipment, and I tell the people at La Fe, I said, I'm going to take off with Jimmy and do some work. And I thought it was all just talk, you know, smoke and mirrors type of thing, you know, how that should go. And I got a call from, I guess, his agent or a friend of his, and they asked me if I would be willing to fly out to Los Angeles to do a workshop for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, yeah, of course, I'm down for that. So I got two cameras, and I went out there. And it turns out Peter Jennings was there with his camera crew. I had a fight for camera angles with his Japanese photographer. They were older men just trying to, you know, like at that point I got like a true introduction to the media world at like 19, 20 years old.
Right.
So,
right.
And then I did the I shot the footage and we ended up doing a sweat inside the prison.
Right. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I thought we were going to go to, it was two Native Americans that were running the workshops. I thought we're going to their home after the prison and then just to do it there. But it turns out we went further into Chino prison and I had to get into and with 50 inmates and like shower with them and go into the, it's like a teepee, but it was made out of mud, right?
Right,
the prison itself. And we did a 4-hour sweat.
That was within the prison?
Yeah, in Chino prison, mind you. Yeah,
we're doing
sweats
in Chino prison, man. That's crazy.
And I was there with a friend of mine, Efren. Well, now he's a teacher over at Berkeley, and back then we were both 19 or 20 years old. And so that was a pretty definitive point in sort of my transition from leaving, having worked with feature films that came into town, because between 95 and 99 or 2000, a lot of films were coming here to El Paso as opposed to going to New Mexico. They were capitalizing on the tax rebates here or lack of unions in Texas.
Right,
And so I shifted from that on into the whole nonprofit realm. That's when I started to gain a little more social consciousness, you know, and that's part of the reason probably why the parallels are there.
I'm sorry, and that's kind of the filmmaking aspect, you know, which you're involved in. Were you already interested in poetry before that, or was that from that kind of inspired you?
I got into poetry. I had a teacher here at UTEP. He was a Syracuse professor. He was here for about a year and a half. And he's the one that I wrote a paper about, you know, the first time, you know, what I did out of high school. And it was just, you know, an introduction to writing class. And he's the one that turned me on to Joseph Campbell and Kerouac and Steinbeck and these guys. He's like, you should read this guy. And and from that point on, it was really Kerouac on the road that kind of caused a shift where I could actually read a book taking the bus home, and I read it in a day and a half or 2 days. And that was like, wow.
You can book for taking buses.
I know, absolutely.
Or trains, too. Yeah.
That kind of makes sense that you were influenced by him. And also, your film, your perspective as a filmmaker seems inseparable from the way your poetry moves, because it is a narrative, but it's a narrative that unfurls, and it's very cinematic. And when we think about the language of On the Road, it pushes, and it just unfurls, and things just fall out of it. And that's kind of where you are as a writer. Tell us how this book came about.
The narrative is strong, and I think that should come through, right?
I had gone to Manhattan about 5 years ago to go work on, actually I went with Jimmy to go, he went to go get a George Soros Award for something he did. Mm-hmm. And myself and a friend of mine, Dr. Joseph Viescas from here, went down there just to experience Manhattan. And I took my camera just to go and shoot.
Was it your first time?
No, it was my second time. Mm-hmm. But it was actually first time really there. Right. Last time I just went there for like vacation, 2-3 days. And it was
Times Square and stuff like that. Yeah.
I get up there and I met with Miguel Angarin, who started the New Rican Poets Cafe. He was Jimmy's friend. And then Tony Spiller, who won the American Book Award some years back. And he's an attorney. He was one of the board members at the cafe. You know, I just made the point of contact with these guys. And I've always wanted to write a book, you know. And so I went there with a different sort of voice in mind, where I went there with a 220-page manuscript of my ramblings and what I thought was my voice, and I thought, this is truth. This is like where it's at.
That's right.
The young poet.
Yes.
That's right. I don't change a word. I don't revise because I like it the way it comes out.
And once I get there, I get to Manhattan, and Tony Spiller gets off of, working as an attorney in Manhattan. He pulls up to the cafe. And first thing he tells me is, hey, we're not going to publish your manuscript. It's crap. You know, that's the first thing he said, you know. And I'm like, oh, man, I was flushed, man. I was like, all right, you know. And so, but they're like, you're here, you're Jimmy's friend, we're going to take care of you, and, you know, you're here for the weekend, you have a good time, you know.
Yeah.
And but the whole time, I'm like heartbroken, you know. So I
Oh, so they told you that at the beginning of the
trip. At the very beginning. That's the first thing.
That's the first thing.
So Manhattan was gray and wet with rain.
Yes, that's
the whole time. Like, I hate this city.
Yeah.
But I'm there with these guys, and you get through it. You're eating great dinner, great food on the Lower East Side. You're drinking and the whole thing. And so I start telling them my story, my family, my mom and my father, and how they met, and how my father was killed when I was 2-3 years old, so I never knew him. And you
write about that. That's a beautiful poem where you write about him being gone.
Thank you.
Leaving the Kentucky Club.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Leaving the Kentucky Club, right.
Yeah, and so I tell them a story, and they were riveted. They're like, "Oh, that's a book right there. If you can write that into a book, we'll publish that."
Right.
And so with that being said, I just went off to the hotel for the next 2 days, and I came up with the first 35 pages of this here. Wow. And they were riveted. They were like, "Oh, this is cool. This is good stuff."
Right.
You know, and Tony invited me to stay for another 2 weeks to write the full first draft.
Right.
And at that point, you know, we became sort of muses and paramours, and and we would just go to, you know, to restaurants and bars and just sit down and write the material and go over
it. Yeah.
And then I went back there for another 2-3 years just to polish it up. And then I was going to get published by the New Eureka Poets Cafe Press when they had it.
Oh, wow.
And they had a press about 5 years ago, but it was dismantled, and just because I guess the board thought it wasn't, you know, being utilized the right way or something. Right. So I had to go off and find it took me 2 years to find Western Edge Press out of Santa Fe to publish it. Yeah.
That's interesting that you say that you started it in Manhattan and would occasionally go back to work on it in Manhattan. It reminds me of Lorianne Guerrero. And,
oh, that's right. That's
she started
right.
that collection of sonnets about her grandfather.
In El Paso.
Yeah. Yeah, and so she came back to revise it in El Paso.
In El Paso, yeah.
Do you find there that even though it's really about El Paso and Juarez in terms of the landscape and very richly described, do you find that there's a little bit of the New York City somehow coming through?
Absolutely,
at all?
Absolutely. Just last night, I started, you know, posting up all my pictures on social media from Manhattan. I don't know why. I thought maybe I'm having some kind of existential crisis or something is going on that's just not right. But I thought, it's the fact that, the reality of it is that I did write that book in New York, you know, and I did have the help of Algarín and Spiller in the sense of it was all my material, but they were right, you know, especially Algarín was right there next to me the whole time in terms of sitting at cafes and, you know, he'd call me late at night. He's like, "Hey, Valentin, go to page 81, you know, change that, you know, that's not, you know."
I could hear it.
Yeah, you know, and so, yeah, absolutely. I think a lot of it, that's a good point. Yeah.
A lot of good writers, I say, if they go to Paris to write, they don't go to Paris to write about Paris. If they go to New York to write, they're not going to New York to write about New York.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to write about where they came.
Yeah.
And that distance, I think, probably helps you understand the narrative from maybe a more distance than you could if you were, you know, looking out the window at, you know, the mountain that says, La Biblia es la verdad.
James Baldwin actually mentioned that same thing. That's why he went to Paris, was because you go to this sort of other space that you even, you know, you yourself are not familiar with. And there's this kind of sense of freedom to write about without any kind of restrictions or any kind of barriers, to write about the place you call home, you know, from this totally free liminal space.
Yeah.
And that's why James Baldwin, that was Paris to him, and for you it was Manhattan.
Yeah, you know, that's an excellent point. Yeah, that's exactly. I probably wouldn't have been able to write what I've written being sort of like caught up in the midst of it here at home with all the, you know, so having the issues around you and this and that, as opposed to having purview and like perspective.
And especially, you know, if you're going there especially to write and you're using your time to write, the city in which you're writing has this way of conspiring to help you deepen your narrative.
You see images
on the street and you go, that belongs
in
my poem.
And then the way that the New Yorkans, you know, love, you know, the way New York embraces the arts. You know, and it got to a point where all these guys would, you know, we're staying off of Houston and like Second, you know, and I learned to call it Houston. I was like, no, it's Houston.
Exactly.
It's H-O-U-S-T-O-N, it's Houston.
Same thing.
They're like,
this is tourist.
They don't like Texas, apparently, you know, and so I had to learn
Houston.
That. Yeah. But they would call me when I would get lost in, you know, coming out of, you know, the bars and the restaurants late at night, and I'd be trying to figure out how to get to my apartment or my hotel. They would just say, hey, yo, Texas, they call me out.
Oh, yeah.
But it was kind of cool because it was endearing. Like, it was more of a point of them having a common ground with me from being, I guess, you know, brown, and we're being with Miguel and these guys. And they would come off and tell me all the stories of Mikey Piñero and Pedro Prieti and how they knew them. And so that was a very cool world. Yeah,
and, you know, one of the things that caught my attention right away about the title is that you have the subtitle, A Bilingual Poetic Narrative of the Borderland. And I'm always skeptical about subtitles, especially in poetry collections.
Yeah.
And, you know, but instantly what it triggered for me was, okay, this author is claiming that this is something different. You know, it's not it's not simply a collection of poetry, but there's actually obviously a narrative. There's something he's trying to do here that requires this kind of a subtitle. And so And after reading it, I thought, this is exactly – this sounds like totally accurate, I think, for as a description for the book, you know. But also because I know some of your own background in terms of filmmaking and screenwriting, you know. And to me, I go, oh, yeah. And I can even actually see the sort of narrative on how you set this up and how it would come from somebody who has the experience of being a screenwriter.
Sure.
You know, the – go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to ask him to read a poem.
Oh, yes. Perfect. Sure. And you know what? We should say to our listeners, we are speaking here with Valentin Sandoval, filmmaker and author of the new poetry collection, South Sun Rises. It's out on Western Edge Press. And so, Valentin,
and it's and it's bilingual in the sense that on the left-hand page is the poem in Spanish, and on the right-hand page is the poem in English. Did you do your own translation?
No. I'm nowhere near that articulate. I did Mabel Weber. I met her through Dr. Cortazar, who used to be the run the consulate, Mexican consulate here. Yeah, it was him, and he put me in touch with his assistant, Mabel Weber. We would go to Eloise or cafes in town to just, you know, sit down over coffee and go over the material just to kind of make sure that it was, you know, she wasn't going off on her own tangents and her own thing. So I was there in the process, but it was really her. Work.
Nice.
Yeah. I'll read the one of my father. This is La Rutera. A homage to my father in terms of the story that I learned from my aunt and from my mom You know, so what little I know of him is I anchored down and I told the story. My father's legacy, almost unknown to me. His early death in his mid-30s. Killed by La Rutera, the buses in Juarez that were known for murdering people with their reckless driving through the potholed streets when it rained. They'd become small lakes and pools where children would bathe. The last night when he was killed, he had finished his journalism work at a local TV station. As he threw his guitar in the back seat of the car on his way to play a show at the Kentucky, where Hemingway and Kerouac would go for drinks. But God figured it was time to take him with all his Mayan German ancestors carving their way up north through Argentina and into Guadalajara and to Casas Grandes, where my father was born. And father, whom I've never known, you and your father and his father and those ancient ones unite to see me, who is them, in full form. And they teach me how to laugh at the sickness when it overwhelms. And like a Buddha, I roar my laugh into the dark. And you had a son who's transcended all dead ends thrown in his path. And your blood lives through his tongue, traveling through your dream into my inspiration.
That was Valentin Sandoval reading from his book, South Sun Rises, a bilingual poetic narrative of the borderland.
So the book, I mean, it's, I guess we could say that, you know, sort of at its core, it's like a narrative about, you know, your family, but it follows your mother from going from Juarez, you know, crossing into El Paso in search of a better life for her children, which you're one of them, and your siblings. And along the way, you know, a series of things happen, and you sort of even tell us about your family's history, but also even the history of this territory, the borderlands, you know, El Paso, Juarez. You give us some of that as well. For me, one of the most, I think, tender, riveting moments was probably the Coyote, that poem. Where the coyote, Manuel, saves your mother from drowning in the river, which was a really heavy. And, you know, I'm also really interested in interviewing people and that kind of thing. And so I wondered, you know, did you grow up hearing that story? Or did you actually, I mean, how did that story come to you, one? And then two, how does your mother feel about you writing those stories?
Yeah, she's the one that told me the story. I probably first heard it when I was in my early 20s, you know, 21, 22, when she would just, you know, tells me as she's cooking, you know, she's all like, goes off into the story of how this this coyote saved her and crossing over and had her having to walk on over here. And just a lot of that I also connected. My older brother was the one that told me that that he was black. And that's the thing, that Manuel was
Manuel.
Yeah, yeah. Was a black coyote.
Because Manuel drowns in the process.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, so... So I pieced it together from my brother and my mom. And mind you, my mom is not, you know, she's old school in the sense of, you know, she's not going to sit down and, you know, open up about her past and tell me details. And so a lot of that I had to elicit from her, you know, and even from my aunts is who I had to get it more from my
the
aunt
family.
Ceci from Juarez, who's more the cool aunt that tells you the truth about everything. And
there's always one.
Yes.
Thank God. And how did your mother feel? Has she read that?
She's... she hasn't read the whole thing, you know, but, you know, she doesn't show her, you know, she's had to be the mother and the father. And I think she's maintained that even when her dad died, my grandpa, I recall her. I have this clear image of her just, you know, while her sisters are crying and, you know, her brothers are there, you know, they're very melancholy. And I see her by herself, you know, just sitting down, just looking down at, with her legs crossed, a nice dress, just kind of looking afar. And it's just a beautiful image I have of her. Just that's her character. She doesn't mean she's detached or disconnected. It's just her way that, she expresses herself.
As you're describing her there, I get the image. On page 69, you have the classic photo poem, and there's a photograph, right, of what I perceived to be your mom with you and your siblings. And she's like that. Her legs are crossed. Her eyes are kind of slightly closed. And she has that exactly as you described her right now.
And you know what's funny? It's not me. I wasn't even born at that point.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I was born. Which one was
Valentine? Yeah, I know. I wasn't born at that
okay.
point.
Okay, that's a great photograph, and obviously a great poem, like an ekphrastic that accompanies that poem also. So, did most of the stories in the book, did you you know, were they kind of stories that you heard just as growing up, or did you actually have to go back and do any kind of interviewing?
I did interviewing with my sister and my brothers, and then, like I said, my aunt was really the big, the big source of information, and a lot of it was just memory, you know, of my grandfather, what I knew of him, and I've only had one picture of my father, you know, that I don't really remember. I was a kid. And so a lot of it was just having to tap into imagination to somehow use metaphor to sort of fill up memory and make it real.
You know the interesting thing about this book is it was written as a book, as opposed to you were writing poems and then realized a book was emerging. And so you intended to write a book from the beginning to the end. Did this affect the way you wrote the poems? Did you write them chronologically? You started from the beginning and then went to the end, or were you writing poems and then later on you decided you're going to how it fit in the narrative?
It was a little bit of both. You know, I think I anchored the Coyote poem has sort of been the grounding narrative of it. So I'm like that's what I would sort of default to as part of the reason why
the central image.
Yes. And I would write the material first and then go back and rearrange it, because it was a lot of it was more rearranging to sort of develop the narrative that's there. It wasn't like I was writing individually, and it was more a piece, and then I would have to rearrange it in the edit.
Poetry works a little different that way than, like, you know, than writing a sort of, you know, a novel or a screenplay. I would imagine where there's this sort of linear narrative that you have to look at. You know,
and really because, like, you know, you guys are novelists, and I think it's. When they asked me, I did an interview for KWRG and MSU, the PBS over there, and then Monica asked me, you know, why did I choose poetry over a novel? I said, well, for one, because a novel is more difficult, you know, at least for me, you know, and the sense of I'm able to somehow be abstract while at the same time being concrete, you know, and just sort of developing the voice, because at the same time, it is my first book, and I hope to be the first of many.
It almost reads like a memoir in verse. You know, it's kind of the feeling you get when you read it. It's almost like a memoir in verse, So, cool.
What helps you determine where a line ends and another one begins? Because, you know, poetry is about the line.
I learned something when I was here at UTEP with a professor back in Michael Wright. He was an NYU guy, and he taught screenwriting. And this was 95. He was here for 2-3 years, and he was out of New York. And he actually was one of the writers on the Basquiat film that they adapted into that. Mm-hmm. And he was a pretty austere professor.
Mom.
He's the one that taught me the adage that I've always liked is you come in late and you get out early, you know. And in filmmaking, I've always used that even as an editor when I'm editing, you know, a video. You never want to let a scene be an end to itself. Otherwise, you make it finite, and subconsciously the viewer is going to like, oh, okay, well, that's already been resolved, and I'm not going to pay attention to it. Whereas if you kind of cut it off, you come in, you know, you make it more elliptical, you come in at a certain point, you keep them intrigued. And I think it's the same thing with poetry. Is more, for me, at least the way I wrote it, I wanted to come in strong jump out at a peak, you know, at the same time.
Right.
And so a lot of the line breaks in this are really based on narrative push.
Yes.
It's interesting. Yeah. I think we have time for you to read another poem. Maybe that poem you referred to, the
Coyote.
That one's a little long, I think.
The photograph?
I was thinking about the photograph.
Yeah, classic photo.
Let me see that. Let's describe the photo. It's a photo of, there's four people, a woman who I assume is your mother, and then a little girl who looks like the oldest, your sister, and then a little boy who looks like the second oldest, and then there's another tiny child who must be the youngest. Is that another brother?
You know, yes, that's Damien, Jose, and Edna.
And they're in front of a chain link fence looking out at the camera.
And this is in Juarez, too, the photograph taken.
This is Valentin Sandoval reading from his new collection of poetry, South Sun Rises.
Classic photo. There's a classic family portrait, an old wood frame photo, engraving its ghost-like essence of our family in the 1980s. Our stoic pose, beautiful, funny, mestizaje, very dated at the same time, centuries in the making, from Roman Catholic to Pentecostal Christian to mestizo Indian shaman, then back again.
That was Valentin Sandoval. Valentin, we're running out of time, so why don't you tell us a little bit about what your projects are currently?
All right. You know what? I was going to say a homage, too, because you know how you mentioned it, mm-hmm. this being like very much like Martina Meditations. And
right.
another writer that I spent time with in Austin that kind of gave me more of a political consciousness as well was Raul Salinas. You know,
oh,
and,
okay.
And he was also a lot of his style I also was able to implement.
That's right.
And,
yeah.
Into this. So it's not
That's
just Jimmy.
Right. No,
it was
for
also,
sure.
It was also it was first Raul that I knew
yeah.
before I got to know Jimmy.
I can see that,
you know?
Too. You're right. Now that you mentioned it. Yeah.
So what I'm doing right now, you asked?
Yeah, yeah. What's your next book? I mean, this one just came out, right?
Yes, in December. It came out
in December. And I imagine you're going to spend the next year or so going doing readings, promoting
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I've been
those things writers need to do.
Yes.
Wow, that's a big commitment.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. I've been touring most of the year. I got some help from my publisher, but for the most part, it's out of my own pocket.
Right,
you know, I went to Monterey Bay, to Berkeley,
Houston. Yeah, you've been getting around.
Houston, Dallas, Austin. Yeah. I first met you in Albuquerque.
Albuquerque, yes.
Doing that, and yeah, Lenzic, that's right, the Lenzic Theater. And I saw you in Houston over at the conference Dagoberto Gil and Lalo Alcaraz and all those, having something with
the
Tony
conference,
Diaz.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That was
yeah,
good.
Yeah, that was really cool. So I just been pushing that and I've got to go to do some political work in Albuquerque so I can go make some money to take myself to Colorado. And I want to end off the year in California, you know, just go and,
yep.
and you know, just stay there for 2-3 weeks and go.
And write about El Paso. We'd like to thank our guest, Valentin Sandoval, for mm-hmm. being on this week's edition of Words on a Wire. Check out his book, his webpage, his IMDb. And
yeah, you got to pick up his new book, South Sun Rises, which it's out by Western Edge Press, right?
Yes.
Why don't we end the show with your favorite quote from a movie, Valentin? Do
right.
you have
it's
one?
You're a filmmaker. We figured.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this might be kind of cheesy, but I've always used it.
We love cheesy.
Hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. That's Andy Dufresne from the Shawshank Redemption.
Oh,
that
nice.
Sounds great.
Andy Dufresne.
That sounds great. Yeah, and you know, anything about hope is all right with me.
Yep.
See you next week.